From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, Gale Foods CEO Catherine Gale on shelf-stable dairy products, the debt ceiling crisis, and why she left the Wisconsin Democratic Party. Later, former Packer George Koontz turns his experiences and his PhD work on life after sports into an upcoming book.
I built that whole identity of being a college athlete, high school athlete, professional athlete. And when that identity was lost, I was lost. And I went through the same grieving as when I lost my wife about 4 years ago.
And some perspective on the history of public transit in Milwaukee as its future continues to be debated.
A lot of people don't really realize that when you look at it now, that there were hundreds of miles of track and you could get all the way out to East Troy on one streetcar from downtown Milwaukee.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. For all the transformation of Wisconsin's economy in the past 30 years, the state is still known as the epicenter of the dairy industry. The state is a leader in the production of milk and milk products like cheese. But we're also a leader in a different corner of the industry, so-called shelf-stable dairy products, from energy and diet drinks to yogurt and pudding to the cheese sauce you might have on the nachos at your next Packers game. Germantown-based Gale's Foods has been a player in the Wisconsin dairy world since the late 19th century. CEO Catherine Gale is the fourth generation from her family to lead the company, but she comes to it from a background outside the dairy and food science world. Her background includes positions at Oracle, with the Chicago Public Schools, and as a special assistant to Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. And President Obama appointed her to the board of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Catherine Gale was our guest in a conversation recorded on the sixth floor of the University Club in downtown Milwaukee last week. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much, Mitch. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's start with the company you lead, Gale Foods. It is not necessarily a brand name that that everyone might recognize. Can you describe the part of the industry that you reside in?
Right. So our company is a good Wisconsin dairy food company. Our customers are in a couple different categories. One is we sell to the global multinational food companies who have the brand names, and then they contract with companies like ours in many cases to actually produce that product that they have created and that they market and sell. But we do the entire production. You know, we source the ingredients, we make the product, we package it, we label it, and then we ship it, in most cases, directly to their customer. So that's contract manufacturing. Then we also do a lot in the food away from home segment. So we'll sell to into the quick serve restaurant channels and also into food service. We do a lot in the concession space. And that actually, in the food away from home, we're behind the scenes in many cases, but we do have a brand name. That we have that brand out there, and we have actually now translated that into our third category, which is retail. And we sell the original, you know, stadium cheese sauce that you can buy for your own Super Bowl party, or let's say when the Red Sox are playing the St. Louis Cardinals coming up.
Let's
both
say that.
Sides can buy that and have the cheese sauce at home.
I gather that way back in the company's early history, this was about being able to provide more consistent dairy products.
Yeah, so I understand that really from probably reading the same thing you read on our company's website, because that is the story of my great-grandfather who founded it, that he wanted to provide more consistent quality butter. And so we were at that time one of hundreds of small Wisconsin dairies. And there's been then just over the next 100 years an enormous amount of consolidation. So really most of those dairies don't exist individually anymore. And our company, even though I'm fourth generation, is essentially a company that was created by my father, who took over in the 1960s and then moved us from being a standard dairy products company into this high-tech manufacturing company that we are today.
Well, and along those lines, how is technology impacting the current state of the industry? What is the cutting edge in the work that you do?
So our food processing is actually enormously high-tech. So people are always very surprised when they come to our company to see the capital investment, the automation, and the technology. So it's not that hard to make a dairy product shelf-stable, But to make a dairy product shelf stable in a way that has you think it's fresh and enjoy that experience is very complicated and difficult to do and expensive to do. That technology all develops in Europe because Europe is the leader in this. I don't know how many people are familiar over in Europe. A lot of times when you get the milk, it comes in a shelf-stable carton, those little brick packs. And so you don't buy your milk in the refrigerated case. You just buy it and it sits on your shelf next to the cereal. And that's the kind of processing that we do. The Americans have never decided to buy their milk that way. Europeans do, and Europeans buy many more products that are processed in this way. And so all the technology develops over there, and then we have to adapt it for the U.S. market because we're regulated by the FDA, and we have to be allowed by the FDA to operate here, and that's a different regulatory regime, so it's reasonably complicated to do so.
What is the kind of skill set? I mean, you have, I think, upwards of 300 employees at your facility. What kinds of skill do they bring to the table?
We're looking for, first and foremost, people who want to be part of a growing team. So there are specific skill sets for jobs, but when we're out in the marketplace now hiring, we're looking for an attitude and an approach to work that involves problem solving and moving the company forward. So it's not come in and do this one job. Now, that's in transition. If you ask everybody at our company, I don't think that that's apparent to everybody in their job yet, and that's where we're going.
And you yourself actually come to the industry from outside of this this field. You are the fourth generation leading the family company, but your background is not in dairy or food science.
Right. So my background is, however, in business and problem solving and bringing people together to address problems. So that works pretty well for the CEO of any business, I think. Although, as I've just referred to, in the case of my employees, I've had to come in and learn deep into what our industry is and our specific issues in food and food processing. But in many ways, I think that there can be strengths from coming from different industries as long as you are very aware of what you don't know or even more precisely, perhaps, Mitch, what you don't know, you don't know. And if you can be careful and thoughtful about that and have a good team around you, then you can make a transition.
We are recording live on the sixth floor of the University Club. Catherine Gale is our guest, and we're talking about your transition into leading the family company, which provides or manufactures shelf-stable dairy products. Has it been rewarding to learn about the stuff that you didn't know or that you didn't know that you didn't know even as you were growing up in this world?
I absolutely love learning new things. And if the learning curve were too flat, then that would probably be not as personally exciting to me. Although you don't get to choose in your job every day to do just things that are personally exciting to you, so that I would handle that. But I've enjoyed that learning curve. That's not a problem. And it continues. I just move on to a new area. Because as our company is still growing, and we have a very aggressive growth plan for the next 5 years, I expect that that learning curve is likely to not change, even though it will be on different aspects of the company.
Is Wisconsin, we hear this debated all the time, is Wisconsin currently a good place for your company to be doing business?
You know, our company is very capital intensive, and therefore we are not a candidate to move the company that we have to another state. So I don't go out and do a comparison shopping between being located here or located somewhere else. I don't find that the government is a large factor in our success right now or in any of the challenges that we're having. They're a role, so they're not invisible to us because we're food and we're highly regulated and everything, but our possibilities are much more generated by things that have nothing to do with the government than do.
So you don't sit there and say, well, if only the
no.
tax climate were like this
no.
or the regulatory climate were like this, we could be doing something
right,
different.
Which isn't to say that we aren't aware of the effect of the taxes on how much we're able to reinvest. That's certainly a concern for any business. And in our case, it's not a gating factor. But we notice what we have left after paying the taxes for reinvestment, and that we all need to be aware of that when we're looking at what's the right policies for our state and for our federal government as well, because you need reinvestment. But really, our opportunities are created by things outside of the government right now, which is great to be in that position.
Well, and maybe this is a good opportunity to shift gears. You have been outspoken in your opposition to the now-ended government shutdown over the debt ceiling and the mm-hmm. Affordable Care Act and your desire to take on the national debt. First of all, what is your view on the temporary nature of the settlement or the settlement as it's temporarily in place?
Well, they needed a temporary settlement because they needed a settlement more than anything. So therefore, I support their doing what they needed to do to avert putting the full faith and credit of the United States government at risk. This is the nth of many temporary fixes and solutions and study committees. So therefore, no, I don't support these temporary solutions in general at all. And I'm hopeful, though, that because this is temporary, we might be able to continue a level of focus, Mitch, on the issue, which might have dissipated if they had allowed themselves more time. Because it did, as distressing as it was, the situation with the shutdown and the question on raising the debt ceiling, it did engage the public in a new way and make more people aware of the issue. So hopefully we're going to remain engaged and be watching, and that will put pressure on them to make some progress during this time.
Well, and you are a member of this national organization, the Campaign to Fix the Debt. Mm-hmm. It is a bipartisan group. But what do you think has been getting in the way of a truly bipartisan effort in Washington to take this issue on?
That is a long question, a good question. I think what's gotten in the way is that our representatives are responding to the needs of a small number of their constituents rather than responding to the larger question of what is necessary for our country overall. That situation, which happens on both sides of the aisle, with Democrats responding to what the far left wants more than the middle, and Republicans responding to what the far right wants, that has been created through two problems. One is structural and one is cultural. And structural is that we have hyper-partisan districts that allow us to elect people who do not have to respond to an overall constituency, but simply have to respond to primary voters at the far side of whatever party their district has been designed to support. And then the second issue is that culturally, the electorate, the voters, us, we are not very involved, and we don't demand something different from our representatives and from all of our elected officials.
Do you think there's a, and maybe this is an obvious question, a certain short-sightedness in the way we as Americans approach problems, whether it's the debt, whether it's environmental issues like climate change, whether it's health care?
Certainly that's human nature. I wouldn't say that Americans are probably worse at that than other people. I think, though, that we can say, yes, that's my nature to think about what it means to me, to think about my pocketbook, to think about my family, and to think about this year rather than 20 years from now. And then we can say, okay, get that's human nature, and I choose to also use the other parts of my human nature, which is the ability to think longer term and to think about things other than just my pocketbook today. I might also want to think about my pocketbook 20 years from now. And what's good for my pocketbook today may not even be good for my pocketbook 20 years from now. So I think there is a short-sightedness on the part of everyone, and I don't believe that can't be overcome.
You worked, if I'm not mistaken, on behalf of President Obama's campaign in the past, but you actually left the Democratic Party of Wisconsin during the recall campaign. What is your concern about the state of partisan politics today?
So I left the Wisconsin Democratic Party because I felt that it set a bad precedent to use the recall mechanism to protest a policy decision which was Act 10, which was passed into law. And I would oppose those types of uses of the legislative process and of the rights of that we have as citizens to recall a governor according to our Constitution. I would oppose that no matter what party was using the mechanisms that way. In the corporate world, sometimes there's a lot of complaint about government regulation. Well, government regulation doesn't just regulate the corporate world. Government regulation, quote unquote, has set up regulations about how government works. You can't regulate an industry to perfect operation, and you cannot regulate the government into perfect operation. It requires people to act in spirit of what the government is supposed to deliver. So technically, we could recall Governor Walker over anything we wanted, and I felt that just because we can doesn't mean we should. An election comes along again every 4 years, you know, for governor. So we can wait, and the Democratic Party in that case and people who are opposed to Act 10 can make their case to an engaged electorate in the regular process. And I think that going back and forth on a policy issue simply invites the, quote, other side to do that the next time when they don't like something that gets passed. And if I could, Mitch, say that we saw the same thing just happened in Washington, D.C., which is we took a policy issue, and it's a big policy issue, there's no question, but it's a policy issue, the Affordable Care Act, passed into law, upheld by the Supreme Court, and a group of people decided to hold hostage. They're not unrelated, because the debt's related to everything, you know, but some unrelated issues over the Affordable Care Act, and that is not going to work. Okay, it's not going to make a functioning democracy. And it doesn't make us safer. It doesn't solve our debt problems. It doesn't improve our education system. It doesn't solve any of the problems that matter to people. And yet that's what we saw happening.
This is as good a time as any to throw the conversation open to any questions from our studio audience.
You talk about two passions that you have in your life, running the family company and a really aggressive growth strategy over the next 5 years. But it's very clear that you have such a passion for some corrective reform in the political process. If we're sitting here 5 years from now, which accomplishment will you be more proud of?
So the fact is that you have to care the most about things that matter to the most number of people. I am enormously dedicated to the health of our business, because of what it means to the community, because of what it means to our employees, because of what it means to my family, absolutely. And I want to see that succeed. The success of my business, our business, will not determine how well we're doing as a state. We'll contribute to the economy, absolutely, and that matters a great deal, but it's not changing the trajectory of things for future generations. So I think that we should all care about our businesses, but we all exist in the larger context of the democracy, so not just what I would be most proud of, but what I would suggest many of us should be most concerned about is the overall health of our democracy, and therefore, to whatever degree, I can be part of a dialogue that contributes to changing the current political climate and therefore the results that we're getting from our government, that would be the most important accomplishment I think that any of us can really be a part of.
Well, and so I think I'm going to ask the question that maybe several people have thought of. Would that extend to running for office someday?
You know, I think that lots of people should really think about running for office, because people should think about being in the dialogue of what matters to our country. Therefore, I, like lots of people, should have thought in my life way back, you know, to grade school, where I did run for office, you know, about running for office. And I think everybody should be considering it. And therefore, that's something that I consider, because I'm watching what's happening all of the time. And right now, I have a priority and a primary responsibility to my company. And because I've been very consistent today in talking about we get the government we deserve and our requirement to be engaged as citizens, I don't think it's necessary to run for office to have a big impact and to be fulfilling, you know, our responsibility. And I think that as much as I say everybody should think about it, that doesn't let those of us who don't do it off the hook for the results that we're getting.
I think we have time for one last brief question.
So it's pretty clear you're a person of many passions. You have your business and politics and some books, your daughter. My question is, how do you prioritize and how do you balance that, still find time for yourself to grow? I mean, it's just a lot of things to juggle.
There's a book, of course, because I read books about all these topics, and it's called The Power of Full Engagement. And the point that they make in that book, and that's been made therefore by other people, that the real question is not a time management question, it's an energy management question. That has really come true to me. I've had some health challenges over the past several years that had dramatically reduced my energy, and there was no amount of time management that was going to make up for not actually bringing forth in the morning the energy to, you know, act on these passions that you've mentioned. So I think that we have an individual responsibility to be watching over our energy, because that is something that dictates the maximum contribution that we can make as individuals, to our families, to our businesses. And so we have to be stewards of the energy that we're bringing. And because I've had these health challenges, I've had to do a lot of figuring out of what I need to do to increase my own energy. And that's, it's still a work in progress right now. And when you have a lot of energy, and I notice it because going from having energy to not having energy really made that clear, you can accomplish so much more. So I invite people to consider what they're doing to increase their personal energy, which in most cases is really how they're taking care of their physical bodies and their mental stress. And increases in productivity is at the heart of what keeps an economy growing and therefore creates opportunity. Making a contribution to the world is a big energy enhancer for almost everybody.
Catherine Gale, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Catherine Gale is president and CEO of Germantown-based Gale Foods, a manufacturer of shelf-stable dairy products. She's also on the board of directors of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Our interview was recorded on the sixth floor of the University Club in downtown Milwaukee last week as part of the club's Enrichment Breakfast Series. You can hear the full conversation at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a short break now, and then the doctoral work of a former Green Bay Packer looks at the adjustment of former athletes to regular life. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Like Effect continues on WUWM, I'm Mitch Tyke. The National Football League has come under fire for its efforts, or what many perceive as its lack of efforts, to protect the lifelong health of its players. Advocates for former players say a lawsuit settlement represents the beginning of an effort to make things better for people who have sustained head injuries, but much remains to be done. And beyond the effects of concussions, former professional athletes face many issues after they leave the playing field. George Kuntz knew a lot about these things even before he started his doctoral research. Kuntz played for the Green Bay Packers for 8 years and the Seattle Seahawks for a year. But more recently, he took a close look at the lot of former professional athletes in his coursework at Marquette. And that dissertation also led to a book due out early next year. George Kuntz is with us in the Lake Effect studio to talk about his work. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mitch.
How did the end of your own football career play into the work that you are now doing?
It was very instrumental because I, when I reflect over my career and my time, especially 2 years out of playing, I was really kind of lost. I didn't really have a place to kind of go and settle in. But I had a lovely wife at the time. She's since passed away. Her name was Tanisha, who encouraged me to go back to school to to really pursue my dreams and everything. And that's what I did. I enrolled at East Carolina University in the sports management program. And from there, I had aspirations to at some point receive a PhD and get into administration on college campuses.
Now, the end of your career, we should flash back to that point. You did not get the big announcement of your retirement and the press conference. You basically just didn't get asked back. And how much of the difficulty is that it was unresolved at that point?
It was very, very difficult, you know, because like so many players coming into the National Football League, they have aspirations to play about 10 years. But in reality, the average player plays 3.5 years. I was very, very fortunate to play 9 years in the National Football League. And I was with a great organization with the Green Bay Packers, 8 years up in Green Bay, 1 year out in Seattle with Coach Holmgren. But it was tough, the whole transition. So therefore, when I got into the PhD program over at Marquette University, and I talked to a couple of my professors, Dr. Richard Jones and Dr. James Holstein, talked about my research project, talked about my dissertation, and we came to an agreement that we should do some research on the whole life after football, the whole transition. And it's been some really good work, and I had a chance to interview over and talk to over 5,000 players. I've interviewed about 21 that I have documentation, transcribed those interviews, and I was able to write my dissertation. And the day that I submitted my dissertation back in May of 2012 is the day when one of my peers, one of my good friends, a guy by the name of Junior Seau, passed away from a gunshot to the chest because he wanted to preserve his brain because he said that he was having all types of suicidal thoughts and all types of issues after his playing days. So he was later diagnosed with CTE, a type of brain disease that comes from constant hits to the head of playing the game of football.
This is, I think, what, chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
You got it right.
Yeah.
Mitch, I couldn't say that.
I'm not sure I could say it either.
You did a great job.
Well, and we hear so much these days about those lingering physical injuries, whether it's the long-term effects of repeated concussions or things like knee and hip and other joint injuries. Are they the primary issue facing former players, or are they just part of a bigger picture?
I think it's a part of a bigger picture. And I think, Mitch, I think you hit the nail on the head. There was a documentary recently on PBS, the NFL Concussion Crisis, the League of Denial. It was in conjunction with Frontline. And they talked about the whole concussions and the whole suicidal and all that. But I think concussions is just one piece of the bigger picture. My personal experience, my mom got me involved in football on the Pop Warner level at 9 years old. And I was very, very fortunate to play until I was 32 years. So I was about 23, 24 years into one sport. I built that whole identity of being a college athlete, high school athlete, a professional athlete. And when that identity was lost, I was lost. And I went through the same grieving that I went through when I left the National Football League as when I lost my wife October the 7th, 2009, about 4 years ago. So leaving the National Football League, or leaving, I think it's applicable to other careers as well. Let's say if you've been a principal, you've been a teacher. Let's say you was in the military, you're a veteran, and you was in one particular role for very, very long, and now you're out. There's going to be a transition process that you have to go through, unlike, you know, be a football player, unlike any other career that you may be a part of.
Do you think, given the reality there, that, you know, you are not unique in the sense that most, if not all, of the players you played with probably came from similar situations? They were introduced to football at a young age. This was a huge part of their life. Do you think leagues like the NFL and even going to big-time college sports, do they owe something to their players to help them through that transition?
There's a lot of resources, Mitch, available. You look at what the NFL Players Association, I think there's enough. If we start playing the blame game, I think there's enough blame to go around to the NFL as a whole, the NFL Players Association. There's blame that can go around to, you know, the families, you know, because a lot of the players in the National Football League, I think about 70% of them are from, you know, from single parent household. You know, it makes that whole transition even harder for those individuals. So.
You've talked to, you said, about 5,000 former players, interviewed a subset of those players. What are the kind of conclusions that you're coming to, and what do you hope, you know, if you could wave your magic wand and say, my research has had exactly the effect that I hope it would, what is that effect?
Well, I think, for one, a lot of players feel like, you know, when they receive that college degree, because there's about 1,800 players in the National Football League, 60% of them have their college degree, unlike, you know, baseball, hockey, and what's the other?
Basketball.
Mm-hmm. We know the rules are different. You have to be 3 years removed from your high school graduation to go into the National Football League.
And do you think that's a good thing?
I think so, especially for football, because, you know, you have to be really, really not only mature from a mentality standpoint, but from a physical standpoint. I don't think a lot of kids are really ready at 18 years old or 19 years old to go into the National Football League. You know, LeBron James, let's say a player like that going to the National Football League is really, really rare, but it can happen. You know, let's say like a Hakeem Olajuwon, who came from Africa, never played basketball before in his life, came to America, went to the University of Houston, played about 2 years and was the number one pick overall. You don't hear about those type of stories.
They're the exception, the rare exception.
Right. But one of the things that a lot of the guys talk to me about is having an opportunity to transition into a job, a real job, because when they leave those college campuses, for one, they can't work because the NCAA said you cannot work and be on full scholarship or be on scholarship, right? So a lot of those guys don't have the skill sets to do anything else. So we got to do some things from a systemic standpoint to give those guys the ammunition to go out there in corporate America to get a job.
There was just a situation in the past few days as we're having this conversation at Grambling State University,
yes,
where players have essentially taken matters into their own hands and said, you know, we're feeling exploited and you're not taking care of us and we're not going to play for you. What is your take on the level of power that the players have at the college level? Should colleges be listening more to their players?
I think so, because, you know, you have the whole conversation that's going on whether players should get paid, the whole amateurism, that whole status. I think my personal take on it, Mitch, I think that there's about to be a movement because, you know, when I was in college in the 90s, I think back then it was a multi-million dollar business. Now, sports is on the college level is a multi-billion dollar level. So I think, Mitch, in the next 2 to 3 years, people will have to figure it out. That's way more smarter than I am. But players are going to be getting paid in some form. I don't know if it's going to be a stipend. I don't know if it's going to be just the revenue sports. But there's going to be some things that's going to be implemented to help to put the players, because it's gotten out of hand. When you're talking about coaches making $6-7 million, and a lot of people may say, "Well, George, you had a scholarship to play for East Carolina. Mitch, let's say you played for Madison, but basically the university is paying themselves." When George Koontz is sitting in those classrooms, and let's say if you playing football for UW-Madison, you're sitting in those classrooms, the university is paying themselves. So I don't know the benefit. All balances out, but the young people that's coming up, that's matriculating through middle school, high school, and into the college game now, I think because there's so much information out there, and I think there's about to be a movement.
Do you worry about public perception? You know, I'm sure there will be people who will hear this interview and will say, well, you know, this is a relatively small group of people we're talking about, and they were paid very well at the pro level for what they did. So why should we be concerned about the welfare of former football players?
Right. Well, let's talk about Johnny Manziel. He's at the University of Texas A&M. Johnny alone brought $137 million to the university. He has a scholarship, about $15,000 or $20,000. Okay. The university had a record fundraising achievement. The university brought in 1 year, 2012, $760-something million.
Right. They're renovating their stadium.
And they're going to put them up to 102,000. So we're talking about major, major money. And like I said earlier, I don't know what that breakout would be, how much a player like that should get paid. But I think a lot of players are saying, you know, we deserve more than what we're getting. How much that is or what that number is, I don't know. But I'm looking at the landscape, it's changing.
you, as we said, you interviewed quite a few former players, and just as a former player yourself, you must see people leaving the game and dealing with many of the same issues that you were dealing with. At one level, it must break your heart a little every time you see this.
It does, because you see a lot of players in the National Football League that was in the locker rooms with me was very, very confident. They were very, very confident in their skill sets, knowing what to do, knowing what was asked of them, and they could go out there and do their job. But once they left the National Football League, and a lot of players I talked to said that that they couldn't really handle not having that structure. Because let's say when I got in the game at 9 years old, I knew basically every day after practice what I was doing, when I would travel. And that happened for 24 years. So when I was out of the game, just that aspect alone, I was lost, you know. And then being depressed because I couldn't do – because I didn't leave the game voluntarily, you know. And so I was very upset on how I didn't leave on my own terms, and that was very, very difficult for me to stomach as well.
Well, and this must be like a stigma on top of a stigma. Like, you know, football players, we don't think of them as, you know, these are guys who are going to deal with depression. These are strong guys who are really in charge of everything.
Right, and then when you leave the game, you're not calling your teammates and saying, you know, hey, Mitch, I'm struggling with family issues. I'm struggling with my family. I'm struggling from a financial standpoint because the whole masculinity kicks in. And a lot of guys don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about the bad. They want to talk about the good. They want to talk about – and when I do talk to my especially guys that was on my Super Bowl team, they constantly want to revisit the glory days. But rarely they want to talk about what's going on from their kids or their spouse or their parents. So, but we have to do some things and let them know that if you need, from a mental standpoint, if you need to see someone, don't be ashamed. I've gone to see someone to talk to because it's tough. And you have a lot of stuff that you're dealing with. And sometimes you just need to talk to somebody to help you work through it, talk through it.
Do you think, has the needle moved on this conversation since you were a player? Are people talking about it and working through it more today than they were 10 years ago?
Mitch, I tell you what, that's one thing that I want to have come out of my research, especially with my professors over at Marquette. We want to really start this conversation, have this dialogue moving forward, because we don't want to be having this conversation, I know, 20 years from now, 15 years from now. We want to be looking at players like a Dave Dorson, who graduated from Notre Dame, who was a trustee at Notre Dame, was an excellent businessman, but then he turned around and killed himself. We don't want to be looking at situations like a Junior Seau. Hopefully we don't get news of other players that decide to take their own life because they feel like there's nothing to live for. We have to implement some things to help those players, because those players, you know, was coming out of their schools, their hometowns, and they were the best, not only on the football field, but in a lot of respects in the classroom as well. So we'd love to have those players to go back into their communities to help change those communities, to make those communities better than what they were when they was in there.
This many years since you played your last game, how is your health?
From a cognitive standpoint, not too bad. I was able to defend my dissertation, and the professors, they didn't beat me up too bad. But but from a physical standpoint, you know, Mitch, I have to have, within the next 2 to 3 years, I have to have a hip replacement and two shoulder replacements. Other than that, I'm doing okay.
When you think back on it, I mean, there was a Super Bowl. There were umpteen games that are still in your memory. Was it all worth it?
Oh, Mitch, that's a great question. I would do it all over again. I would have those 7 surgeries again, the 3 that I'm probably going to have within the next 3 to 4 years. You know, when I was a little boy, 9 years old, there was about 7.2 million playing Pop Warner flag football. There was 96 linebackers. When I play, there's 96 linebackers now in the National Football League, and I was one of them. Coming from a small town, I couldn't ask for anything else. I would do it all over again, but I just want to take the research that we're doing over at Marquette to make the young people that's in Pop Warner and flag football, when they get to the National Football League 10, 15 years from now, that they have a better transition than a Junior Seau or George Kuntz or Brett Favre or Reggie White or Leroy Butler. That's my goal.
George Kuntz, thank you so much. Best of luck with your work.
Appreciate it, Mitch. Thank you so much.
Dr. George Kuntz played in the NFL for 9 seasons, 8 with the Green Bay Packers. He's now working with the Marquette University Urban Scholars Program. A book based on his doctoral work with former professional athletes is due out early next year. It is not just former football players who have trouble coping off the field. Lake Effect essayist Nilesh Patel looks at the death of a well-known hockey player 2 years ago as evidence that change is needed inside and outside of sports.
I wish I had known about Derek Bougard before he died. This 28-year-old Canadian was a fan favorite in the National Hockey League when he lost his battle to addictive prescription painkillers 2 years ago. Sadly, Bougard's story isn't unique. Millions of Americans, from professional athletes like Derek Bougard to hockey moms, are fighting for their lives, and they may not even realize this. Prescription opioid abuse is the fastest growing drug addiction in the country today. In 2010, there were enough prescription painkillers written to medicate every American around the clock for a month. Think about that. We could medicate every American 24/7 with painkillers, and the numbers are growing. Prescription-related drug deaths are up 400% in the last 11 years. 16,000 U.S. citizens died in 2010 from painkillers. ER prescription-related cases are up as well. 500,000 people went to the ER with drug overdose issues. Patients want quick solutions to their medical problems. As a physician, I'm expected to maintain high level of patient satisfaction. Unfortunately, patient satisfaction is an oxymoron. In the world of instant online surveys and social media postings, anything less than immediate gratification may cause viral and vocal patient dissatisfaction. This contributes significantly to the overprescription problem. Change should start with my brother and sister physicians, my colleagues. We must guard against an overreliance on prescription painkillers as a default go-to treatment for pain. We must find the root cause of pain problems and treat them with the best possible options, even if it takes longer to see the patients and longer to see the results. Lawmakers can also help. Under HIPAA, the Patient Privacy Act, I'm not allowed to tell anyone if I'm suspicious of a patient who's doctor shopping. Patient privacy should be a sacrosanct, but don't silence me when the next Derek Bougard walks into my office. A law which protects a person at risk really protects no one. Give doctors a chance to make a difference in their communities. Finally, to my patients, you also have a role in this. A potentially addictive drug is not a panacea. At best, it's a band-aid, a stopgap measure. You must push yourselves to lose weight, to stop smoking, and to walk regularly. Contrary to what you might think about resting up to ease the pain, even a small amount of exercise can help minimize pain. Derek Bougard's family is suing the NHL for negligence in their son's death. If there is an upside to this loss, it is that the suit could force a paradigm shift in how powerful painkillers are prescribed, a shift that is long overdue. The loss of any child, especially one as talented as Derek Bougard, is so tragic. But there is a small window of hope for the Bougard family, that their loss will be a bellwether event for the rest of us. Let Derek Bougard's fatal overdose from prescription painkillers be the last one. If this can happen, and this I believe with my heart, he will not have died in vain.
Dr. Nilesh Patel is a partner with Advanced Pain Management Clinics and has practices in Milwaukee and Green Bay. One last break, and then how Milwaukee County's transit system was first funded. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Late last week, a decision over the future operation of the Milwaukee County Transit System was put off for another year. County Executive Chris Abley made the announcement that the county's contract with the nonprofit Milwaukee Transport Services would be extended for a year. That will allow officials to mull over the potential awarding of the future contract to the for-profit Texas-based MV Transportation. MTS has held the transit since the public transportation system became fully public in the 1970s. This controversy over transit's operation is not the first time the operation of transit has been a complicated question here. Abby Callard writes about transit's history and the current issues in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and she joins us to talk about that earlier history. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. The first part of this feature in the November issue looks back, way back, to the distant past. And one of the interesting points I think it makes is that transit and transit funding has never been a normal, stable affair right from the point transit came along here. How was transit first started in Milwaukee?
You know, I think that's definitely true. And it was really started sort of as a grassroots effort with Walker, who Walker's Point is named after. It was with these sort of horse-drawn streetcars. So that's really where it started. And, you know, as the point that Joe Caruso makes in the story, that if you look at transit today, you can really trace it back to those original streetcars, which I think is really fascinating.
And Joe Caruso, we should mention, was in charge of marketing for more than a quarter century for Milwaukee
yes,
County Transit.
Yes, a very, very long time, and he is sort of one of those guys that knows almost everything about the system.
Well, and so for the first portion of transit's history, it was actually, if I'm not mistaken, wrapped up with electric production.
Yes, it was, and that was also really interesting to figure out, and I don't think a lot of people know that. You know, when electricity sort of first happened, which sounds sort of silly now, you know, the thing that about electricity is that you can create it, but you can't store electricity. So once you create it, you either have to use it or you lose it. And so, you know, the streetcars, the electric streetcars were actually just sort of one more way for them to sort of sell and use this electricity.
We've generated this much power. We got to use it somehow. Let's build a streetcar.
Mm-hmm. And then they sort of figured out that selling power to citizens was actually going to make them a lot more money than running public transit. So then they sort of veered off in that direction.
And it sounds like for a good long while, the company that was operating the streetcars was looking for a way to stop operating the streetcars.
Yeah, exactly. They sort of figured out pretty early on that it wasn't going to be profitable. But because of all of these sort of federal regulations, they had to keep the system going. Because they started it, they were the ones that were going to have to keep going unless they could find someone else to do it.
And buyers were not readily apparent.
No, they were not.
And I gather at one point there were streetcars that went almost everywhere. I mean, you head out at one point to the last remaining tracks from this network, which still exist out in East Troy. But you could take express trains all the way as far out as Waukesha. And it was a pretty comprehensive system for a good long while.
It was. It really was. And I think a lot of people don't really realize that when you look at it now, that there were hundreds of miles of track and you could get all the way out to East Troy on one streetcar from downtown Milwaukee.
And so at what point did the streetcars go away?
You know, it sort of depends on kind of which line. They really sort of died in the 50s, is sort of when sort of the last lines were ripped out. You know, that's when buses started becoming more popular, and buses are, they involve a lot less sort of time to start, right? Because you can just tell a bus, oh, I want you to drive down this street instead of this street, whereas, you know, the streetcar, you need the line. You need the actual track.
Sure. Well, so when did transit actually even become a public institution here? This is much later than in many, many places.
Yeah, it wasn't until 1975, until the county sort of took over the system. So it's, you know, relatively recently in transit's history.
Well, and even then, it sounds like there were concerns about whether the county's takeover of the transit system was concerns about how it was going to be funded.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I think that's sort of one of the misconceptions that's come out recently is that while it is owned by the county, it's operated by a private entity.
There was never a dedicated funding source set up aside from property taxes.
Right. And I think, you know, something that's in the story that was really interesting for me to read was this article from, you know, I forget now if it was the Journal or the Sentinel at the time because they were still separate, was talking about how, you know, this silly notion that the people shouldn't pay for transit. And so once the county gets rid of this silly notion, then, you know, we'll have funding. And that's something that, you know, that silly notion, if you will, still exists today.
And Joe Caruso, who you talked to extensively for this article, kind of points to, I think it was 1982 as maybe the heyday for Milwaukee County Transit as it exists.
Yeah. And that's sort of what he was pointing at is, you know, the peak of ridership, the peak of service. And, you know, I don't want to say it's all been downhill since then. But
when did things really start to falter?
Most people I talked to said around 2000, 2002.
And what happened then?
the funding sort of took a dive. That was when the whole county pension scandal started happening. So the county sort of had to tighten up its budget. So there was less funding. And then another thing that happened was Scott Walker was elected county exec, and he is not too favorable to public transit and certainly isn't at the state level either.
Abby Callard, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Abby Callard is an assistant editor at Milwaukee Magazine. There's a link to her article on the history of public transit funding in the Milwaukee area, an article written before last week's developments, we should add, from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. That's the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. We're here every weekday morning at 10 and Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 3. You can also listen online at your leisure. Check out WUWM.com and find out how to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find the complete program schedule and much, much more about this station. It's all online at WUWM.com. Thanks again for listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.